Good to have you here tonight. There are visitors. We're glad you're here. You'll turn to John chapter 4. We are still in that context. We're talking about Jesus and a Samaritan woman that he met by what was formerly known as Jacob's Well. And the conversation he has with her, again, a very interesting one, in which she is there strictly thinking about the things of this life. And Jesus has as his goal to turn her from someone who's just thinking about the things of this life to realizing that she has what? She has a need that she doesn't yet understand, and it's not a physical need. And he is also going to introduce himself, and that's what we were talking about last week, because Jesus tells her in verse 10, if I'm correct, he says, if you knew who it is who offered to you the drink, or I'm just going, if you knew who it was who said to you, give me a drink, you would ask from him the living water. So she doesn't know who he is, and we talked about last week, she didn't yet understand the need that Jesus had come to fulfill. And so he's in the process of both introducing himself and teaching her about the needs that she had. Thank you. All right, so John chapter 4, we've talked about again this encounter that took place in the city of Sychar. It was near Mount Gerizim. And how did Mount Gerizim figure into the conversation between Jesus and this woman?
Well, that's where the Samaritan worshipped.
Okay, and so after Jesus had introduced the fact that he knew all about her life and knew about the fact that she had been married how many times? And that the person she was now with, not her husband. We talked about how, again, the conversation changed. Again, perhaps not wanting to have Jesus go into any more depth about that, she brings up the question, and her question was,
Our fathers worship this mountain. He said, Jerusalem is the place where they are.
Okay, so that's her question. And again, was that a legitimate, was she making that up? Was that, you know, is that a legitimate question?
Yes.
It was. And they, for all we know, could have been standing this close to what is Mount Gerizim there on the left. And she could have been saying, right there is where, again, we used to worship. And we pointed out that in one, and I forget, it was 100-something B.C. that John Hyrcanus destroyed the temple that was on that mountain. But again, to the Samaritans, that was always their place.
I was just going to say, it's not really a question that she's making a statement.
It is an issue. It has been a question. It's been a source of debate, you know, between Samaritans and Jews.
She's just pointing out what the issue is.
Right.
There's really no question there. She just say it. So you say this, and we say that.
But kind of in there is a question, though, right? I mean,
the unwritten question or the unspoken question.
Right.
Who's right?
Right, exactly. Again, this has been the age-old debate, you know, between Samaritans and Jews. You say Jerusalem, we say this mountain. And again, the mountain that, again, would have been within viewing distance of where they were at. So Jesus then responds to that in verse, beginning in verse 21. And let's go ahead and now read. Actually, let's begin in verse 19 and read on down through verse 26. John chapter 4, 19 through 26. Carolyn?
The woman said to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is a place where men ought to worship. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will things to us. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he.
All right. So again, Jesus, in responding to this statement, this debate that has been going on for many years, for centuries, or generations, this has been going on, tells her, beginning in verse 21, that woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. And if you're having a discussion with someone about a controversy, and they say, is it A or is it B? And the person says, it's neither. What does that do to, again, kind of the nature of the debate?
It's changed course.
It's kind of like, well, I was expecting you to, defend Jerusalem, and I was going to defend this mountain, and now you've gone somewhere completely different with this. Was this the answer you suppose she was anticipating hearing? No. And again, would this be the answer that a Jew would expect? No. I mean, so Jesus is going now in a whole different direction, and again, it kind of disarms the woman, doesn't it? Vic, you're smiling.
Well, I can't hardly help it. You make a comment that Jesus said something that she really didn't expect. It seems all through this discourse, Jesus has been saying things she didn't expect. All the way from the beginning. Of this.
Yeah.
And now the tide is turning from temporal things to he's teaching her spiritual things.
He's trying to take her somewhere, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah.
There's an objective to this.
And that ability to, again, take a conversation that we might have with someone and, again, have something in mind that we want to take them. We want to take this person, our neighbor, a family person, something like that. There's somewhere we want to get to. And oftentimes in the discussion with a family, neighbor, friend, we're trying to get there, but the conversation is kind of going all over the place. And it takes work sometimes to keep the conversation going where we want it to go, to get to the end point we want to get to. And again, the end point that Jesus wants to get to is to, again, instill in her, really, I think there's two objectives here. One is to help her understand the need she didn't know she had. And two, to introduce himself as not just another Jewish man, but again, to help her understand that she, in fact, is the Messiah. That he, in fact, is the Messiah.
That would be unexpected.
It's not unexpected that I would have a slip of the tongue. So, in this response, and it's interesting that as part of this response, Jesus told the woman, first of all, you worship that which you do not know. And when we think about that, we go back again to 2 Kings chapter 17, as we've referenced many times. And in fact, the Samaritans worship. Again, we made this point, but in that context, the worship of God was treated as the worship of who? Or what? It was just another God. It was just another, as if an idol, right? I mean, it was just, and the bottom line is that did they know God? Did the Samaritans know him? And have they known him for a long time? And so was Jesus accurate in saying, you worship that which you know not? Yeah.
Just for the sake of review, would you review them or rehearse the story of how the Samaritans came to be in 17 and how their knowledge of God was made known?
All right. So how did this come to be? First of all, this is at a period of time where we're talking about the time frame of about 720 B.C. And ever since the two southern tribes and then the 10 northern tribes had split away and had a separate king, had the northern 10 tribes ever worshipped God according to truth? No. From the day one, Jeroboam had set up different places of worship. As you read about it, he divides in his own heart. And ever since then, they had rebelled against God. They had been idolatrous. And finally, in around 722, so about a couple hundred years later, after the northern 10 tribes had become Israel, God had had enough, and what was the empire reigning at that time?
Assyria.
The Assyrian Empire, and God used the Assyrian Empire to conquer and overtake the 10 tribes. And when the Assyrian Empire conquered the land, what did they do with the people they conquered? They in large part, just they took them out of their land and brought them to their turf, as we might be able to say it. But as you read from 2 Kings 17, what was the problem? So they would take the people out of the land, and then they would repopulate that land they took with their own people, right? But what happened in 2 Kings 17 that caused them to actually bring back some of the people that they conquered back into the land?
God sent lions.
God sent lions, and lions do what?
They
eat people. They eat people. And that was a bad thing, and they got the idea that, that we don't know the God of this land, and so what was the Assyrian thought process then?
Maybe we offended the God of Assyria, so let's bring one of his priests in and see if he can square it up.
Okay, and so they brought some of the priests back.
One of the priests.
They brought one of the priests back, thank you. And again, how much would he have known about true worship? And in fact, we read in 2 Kings 17 that again, they then treated the worship of the God of Israel as it already been said,
just another one in the bunch.
It's just another one of the idolatrous gods. And from that time period on, again, the Samaritan people were then, were they, again, purely Jewish anymore? No, because they had intermingled with the Assyrians. And again, they were referred to and considered a mixed race of people. And they were people from that point onward that, again, worshipped a God that they didn't know. I'm not sure if it was a second cousin of, again, the true God that had led them out of Egypt and helped them conquer the Promised Land. Randy?
Would you like me to read that passage?
Verse 34?
Maybe part of it.
Let's see.
I'm going to 34, 35.
Okay, go ahead.
27.
Go.
2 Kings 17:24, beginning of 27. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, "Take one of the priests whom you carried into exile, and let him go and live there, and let him teach the custom of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away into exile from Samaria came and lived at Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own, and put them in the houses of the high places which the people of Samaria had made, every nation in their cities which they lived. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Binoth, the men of Cuth made Virgal, the men of Hamath made Hashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Serpharites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Amalek, the gods of Sepharvaim. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves priests of the high places who acted for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods according to the custom of the nations from among whom they had been carried into exile. To this day they do according to their earlier customs. They do not fear the Lord. They do not follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law or the commandments which the Lord commanded the sons of Jacob whom he named Israel.
All right. So again, key on verse 34 there in terms of did they know the Lord? It says, and emphasis, to this day. They do according to their earlier customs. They do not fear the Lord. They do not follow their statutes, their ordinances. Again, it was an ongoing thing. They don't know God. They don't care about his statutes or his ordinances, what he would have to say. And so he was just another idol to them. So, again, it's interesting. Again, so Jesus tells this woman, "You worship that which you do not know." And again, would there be something inside of us if someone said, "You're worshiping ignorantly. You worship that which you do not know." would that kind of arch your back a little bit? Yeah, I mean, that's not exactly a compliment, is it? But, again, it appears, again, she listens to this. She's, again, already been told when he tells her, you worship that which you do not know. He's already told her that true worship is not on this mountain or it's not in Jerusalem. So, again, is kind of curious as to where Jesus is going with this. Randy?
I was just going to say that just before she says, our fathers worship this mountain, and you people say that Jerusalem is the place where you're not worshiped, the last thing she said before that was, I perceive that you're a prophet.
Yes.
First thing he does is prophesy. Very first thing. Believe me, an hour is coming, neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Automatically, the very first thing he does is tell her he foresees the future.
Right.
Here's the way it's going to be.
Right.
Then he says, here's the way it is. You worship what you don't know.
Yep.
I just thought that was interesting. She perceives that he's a prophet, then he prophesies.
Yep. So again, you worship that which you know not. Then he said what? We
worship that which we know.
That which we know for
salvation is from the Jews.
Salvation is from the Jews. Again, it was just a bragging point. Is this just to kind of boast about the fact that I'm Jewish? And what's the point here?
It's the truth. God's plan.
It was good. This is God's scheme of redemption. We talk about, you know, God's plan to save mankind. And from the very beginning, before the foundation of the world, God had a plan. And that plan was going to include a Messiah, a promised one. And that promised one, the Messiah, the King of Kings, was going to come through some lineage, wasn't he? And it was God who said he will come through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and through my people that I will call out of Egypt. And this was God's plan. And so you know, it's interesting when you look at Romans chapter 3. What's the question Paul asks in Romans chapter 3 and verse 1?
What advantage does a Jew have?
Is it in Romans chapter 1 and 2, what does he establish in those first two chapters?
Everyone's lost.
That mean the Jews?
Jews
and the Gentiles.
Jews and Gentiles.
So you could see perhaps the Jews saying, well, again, what's the point? But in Romans chapter 3, verse 1, the question is there any advantage then to being a Jew? And was there?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
The advantage was, in Romans chapter 3, and verse 2, he says, or what is the benefit, what is the advantage of the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? Verse 2, great in every respect, first of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. Entrusted with the oracles of God, meaning that all the promises came through the Jews. That his revealed will, the promises, the prophecies came through the Jewish lineage, from Abraham, the seed of Abraham. So was there an advantage to being a Jew? Yes, because you had all of these promises. You had the prophecies, the foretelling of the Messiah, the one to come. Now, does that mean the Gentiles wouldn't benefit from that? No. But it came through the Jewish lineage, and the promises were theirs, and God's revealed will, and God's covenant relationship was with the Jews. And so there was an advantage. Randy?
From a practical standpoint, they didn't have to be, Jews didn't have to be shown that there is one God. They'd known from centuries gone by, there's one God. Whereas the Gentiles had to be convinced that there's only one God because they believed for centuries that there's many gods.
Right. Carolyn?
Also, the Jews, because of this advantage, should have known. They should have recognized. That should have been part of that advantage, but yet they didn't. So to some, it made no difference.
Absolutely. I believe it's Acts chapter 13, as it were. Paul talks about the fact that the scriptures read every Sabbath day should have prepared you, you should have been aware of the Messiah from the scriptures that were read every Sabbath day. Again, the advantage that the Jews had, they had those scriptures pointing to the promised one. And if they'd been listening, absolutely. Mickey?
I was thinking the point in Acts 13, very good, but I was thinking just back a little bit about the same sermon presented by Stephen in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen said, verse 53, ye who received the law as it was ordained by angels and kept it not. Now that's just a brief snip of what he had to say to them. But he tells them, you had the law.
Yeah.
You didn't keep it.
It was yours.
It was yours.
Again, in the passage in Acts 13 that I was referencing is verse 27, where again Paul says, for those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled these by condemning him. So again, they had that opportunity to hear, to listen, to hear these prophecies. And again, that was an advantage to them. You look at Romans chapter 9, beginning in verse 3, where Paul says, for I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. Verse 4, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service and the promises, whose are the fathers and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh. So again, he makes that point in Romans 9. The Christ, the Messiah, came through who? Through the Israelites. Again, this promised one is through your lineage. And so when Jesus simply says that we worship that which we know for salvation is from the Jews, again, it's not to say we're better people than the Samaritans. It just means that God's plan to redeem all mankind, it came through the Jewish lineage. It came through the law that was revealed to them and the promises that were given to them. So, again, having made that point, it's interesting also to note that the woman asked about worship. Again, you go back to her question in verse 20, our fathers worship in this mountain, and you people say that Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Interesting that, is she talking about who to worship? All she said is where. And again, as we made the point, were the Samaritans clear about who to worship? No, I mean, they were all over the board in terms of who to worship. But in responding to the point about worship, Jesus answers about not just worship, but worship of the Father, of the God who created the world and all things in it. You think about Acts chapter 17 and Paul on Mars Hill, where they had an altar to every god, including the God that they were afraid that they had missed. And Paul in Acts chapter 17 wanted to introduce them who believed in all sorts of gods to the one God who made the world and all things in it. And again, it's interesting that she says, I'm just asking you whether we worship at this mountain or in Jerusalem. And Jesus says that it is a matter of worshiping the Father. Again, verse 21, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship. And he didn't end there. He said, will you worship the Father? So it's not just the fact of where, and he's addressing that, but he's addressing who. And it's worship of the Father, the God of all creation. So, but again, he is making the point that it's not about where, but it's about who. And then what's the other question in terms of, again, do you remember, anybody ever take a journalism class and there's the five questions, right? Right. And so he's taking care of the where, which is, it doesn't matter where. Is he addressed the who? the Father, what does he address in verse 24? What question is he addressing?
The
house. The house. It's not a matter of where, but just a matter of who. It's a matter of how. In terms of the question then of when, does he get into the when in this discussion? No. Well, I was thinking more in terms of the point of upon the first day of the week type thing. He's not defining, he's not saying that it used to be on the Sabbath day and now it will be on the first day of the week. But yes, he's defining the overall context when he says, and now is. Absolutely. So the question of how is of critical importance here. If you'll turn to Hebrews chapter 9. In Hebrews chapter 9, again, the Hebrew writer throughout the book of Hebrews is contrasting what? Really? The old and the new, right? And he's comparing and contrasting worship under the old law and worship under the new covenant. And in verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 9, Hebrew writer says, "Now even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary." Did the old law, again, have something to say about where? Yeah, again, he says, regulations of divine worship in the earthly sanctuary. There was a sanctuary. There was a place where that worship was to take place. There was to be a tabernacle prepared, again, verse 2, the outer one in which were the lampstand and so forth. And so there was the where and the articles of worship that were to be incorporated. But as I mentioned in Acts chapter 17, in verses 24 and 25, in this sermon on Mars Hill, so we made the point that's where Paul had said, "The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things." Again, that point in verse 24, that the God that we are to worship is a God that does not dwell in temple made with hands. He is not one who is confined to an earthly sanctuary. And if you study from Acts 17, you study religion in the city of Athens, again, it was not just the preponderance of idol worship, but they were very devoted to their idolatrous worship. And in fact, when it said there in verse 25 that nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath, that in fact many of the idolatrous temples there, the people who worshiped there felt compelled to go and provide for their God. That is, they would come and bring food. They would bring the needs of their God to that place, because they felt that their God needed their help and their assistance in that place. And again, Paul there in the city of Athens says, the God who created the world doesn't dwell in the structure. It's not about coming to a place, a single place, any longer to offer your worship unto him. And my question to all of us is, in terms of, as we think about Old Testament worship, under the old law, did it have to be done where God said for it to be done?
Yes.
And under the old law, if you deviated in one aspect from the law, did anything else matter once you have deviated? If you then decided I'm going to worship somewhere else, I mean, you might as well just, you can do anything, right? And so when Jesus says that an hour is coming and now is, when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship, what has he just done regarding all Old Testament worship? If if worshiping in Jerusalem is not required anymore, doesn't that take the whole law with it?
Priesthood.
It's all gone. It's all gone. By that statement that neither in Jerusalem nor in this mountain, Jesus is now saying all Old Testament worship is now gone. And so in James, what is James chapter 2 and verse 10? Can somebody read that for us?
Whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend one is guilty of all.
All right. And again, we use that point to say, are there some who want to, and I studied with, whenever Stephen, shortly after Stephen Harper Hiller last gospel meeting, I remember I was studying with someone that he and I had met having lunch one day. And eventually we got to the point of where the whole discussion was going to. And basically, he wanted to bring certain aspects of Old Testament worship in, i.e. instrumental music and so forth. But the whole fact of the matter is that if you leave out one part of Old Testament worship, it's all off the table. And again, if we're guilty in one point of the law, we've become guilty of it all. So again, just making the point that when Jesus said, neither in Jerusalem nor on this mountain, that was a broader statement than just the location has changed. And in fact, when he said, not in Jerusalem, he is now saying that worship in total has changed. Again, that the Old Testament regulations of worship are now not going to govern here in the day of the kingdom. Randy?
I just want to clarify. When he says in verse 21, an hour is coming, it's future tense. He's not saying, as of this moment, temple worship's gone, synagogue worship's gone. He's not saying that. He's saying it's going to happen. He's prophesying. This is what's going to be.
In his kingdom.
In his kingdom. An hour is coming, and now it is, in verse 23. What is now, and has previously been, is worshiping the Spirit of Truth. If you're not worshiping the Spirit of Truth, you're not worshiping at all.
Well,
made out of the Bible. They weren't worshiping the truth because they weren't doing what they were told.
While Jesus was on earth, Jesus was establishing his covenant, was he not? The covenant that would come into effect is Hebrews chapter 9, I believe it is, upon his death. But the terms of this covenant, he's beginning to define here, is he not? In terms of, again, when my kingdom comes, when my covenant is in effect, it's not going to be a matter of worshiping in this mountain or in Jerusalem. It's going to be worshiping God in spirit and in truth, worshiping the Father. So absolutely no, it wasn't to say at this very moment now, go ahead and tear down the temple. But it's, again, he is speaking of, yes, in his kingdom. Mickey?
I don't want to make too much of that because Jesus has just told Nicodemus what he's going to need to do to be in the kingdom.
Yeah.
And that's yet future. And here we see that Jesus, in talking about acceptable worship, not in Jerusalem, the Lord out there is afraid it's not going to be in the temple. Yet we know that Jesus is just beginning his earthly ministry. And John records the accounts of Jesus going to the temple. Worship. That's how we know that he preached for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
So this is not saying no more worship in the temple.
Yeah.
Because Jesus himself went
right
to the temple 3 times in his preaching life. That's how that's measured.
Absolutely. Alright, so look at verse 23. Again, you worship that which you do not know. We worship that which we know for salvation from the Jews. Verse 23, but an hour is coming, and now is, as we've talked about, when the true worshipers, the fact that he uses the word true worshipers indicates that there can be and is, are, false worshipers. When true worshipers, that's lost my place there, will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people, the Father, was the operative word there, seeks to be his worshipers. The fact is that our God created all things. He's looking for his created beings to do what? He's looking for people to worship him, to give honor to him, to recognize him. In Romans chapter 1, when Paul talks about the evidence for God, the fact that we should be able to look around at the things that he's created and discern two things: what? His invisible attributes and his power. As we look around, and we should discern that there is a God who's created all things. That there are some responsibilities of all created beings. Let me just pick up verse 24. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, having been understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Notice verse 21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculation. From verse 21, I would suggest that all created beings have three responsibilities towards their Creator. Number one, to know him. Number two, to what they didn't do.
Give thanks.
Before that.
Honor
him. Or give thanks. Am I out of order? But they did not honor him as God or give thanks yet. So again, I think there's three things that God seeks from every one of us. Number one, know him. And although God says, even though they knew God, I would suggest, did they truly know God? I would agree with that. Even though they knew God, they didn't fully know God as he was to be known. But he says, what you definitely did not do is what? Didn't honor him as God. And part of honoring is what? What we're talking about here in verse 23 of John 4. It's to worship him. It's to recognize him. As we talk about him, to acknowledge him as God, as our Creator. And then number three, he said to give thanks to him. And that's part of worship, isn't it, also? To give thanks to God is part of our responsibility to worship. But again, Jesus says God seeks people to worship him, to recognize him, to honor him, to know him, to thank him. Somebody had their hand up, Randy.
I was just going to say that the knowledge of God in verse 21, Romans 1, in the context of verse 20, is knowledge of the existence of God. Verse 20 says, you're without excuse. If you can see what's been created, if you don't believe God, you're without excuse. That's in the context. The knowledge of God in verse 21 is just the knowledge that he exists. And then, growing on that, honoring God and giving thanks.
Right, whereas, again, the type of knowledge that we're to have, I think, is what we read about in some of Jeremiah 9. Yeah, Jeremiah 9, verse 23, thus says the Lord, let not a wise man boast of his wisdom, let not the mighty man boast of his might, let not a rich man boast of his riches, but let him boast of this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises loving kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth, for I delight in these things. God says that's the type of knowledge that he seeks. Not just that we kind of recognize his existence, but that we reverence and honor him, that we thank him as part of that. Mickey?
You're probably going to get this, and I don't want to get too far before the Lord. But in verse 23, when it says he seeks truth, worshipers. Someone mentioned, I think maybe Bruce or someone over there, that there can be false worshipers,
right.
Pretenders. We call them hypocrites. The Lord called them hypocrites, Matthew 23. But I think there are those that claim to worship God, like this Samaritan woman. She had no concept of who God is. But yet at the same time, she claimed that she worshiped God. No, you don't know who God is. You can't worship somebody that you don't know. You're not a true worshiper. And Jake made a point a while ago, I know, that was rather interesting. We were talking about in Acts 17, where these people have put up an altar to the unknown God.
Right.
So they're worshiping this thing unless they leave somebody out. What do they know anything about?
Right.
They know nothing about God. They don't know who it is that they're worshiping. So here are worshipers who are not true worshipers. And I think there's a valid point here to be made that there are worshipers that are not true worshipers.
Well, there's that one. That's where we're going. So
I should be right on.
Yeah.
While I'm on that point,
go ahead.
I done quit studying and started preaching.
With one out of
the text of Acts 17, in conjunction with what you said, that they should seek God. If happily they might feel after him in mind, though he's not far from us. There's no excuse for not being a true worshiper. You just don't want to.
Right. All right.
Just quickly, whenever this subject comes up, I think about Paul listing in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 about the dangers that he's been through. And in verse 26, he talks about frequent journeys and dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. Just stands out as you're reading down that.
Sure.
Dangers among false brethren. So the people you worship with at church, where else would you find false brethren?
Right. Very good. All right.
I thought it was interesting, too, that he says that there are fake worshipers, people who can't worship in knowledge of the true God, but it also says that the Father is taking action. So God is taking action to find those people and establish a relationship. And it's interesting that in the case studies that you look at in the scriptures, people who are worshiping unknown, God has preached to them.
Yes.
And so the truth is found a way into their life, even though they are grasping in the dark for something.
Is God looking to write them off?
Yeah.
No. Again, yeah, those who aren't worshiping him.
It's not hopeless.
No.
If you're trying.
No, but again, that call in Acts 17, which again, I think very clearly goes here with John chapter 4, is to make the point that God declares unto which men?
All
men.
Everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. So again, this is the call for all of mankind. This is an opportunity for those who aren't worshiping according to truth. So again, God is looking for worshipers, but again, he's... Okay, go ahead.
On your point, Paul himself is an example of that. He was more zealous than Paul, but he was doing it wrong. God brought the message to him in a good way.
Right. Bruce, you have your hand up?
Yeah, it's just interesting. When you go back to Acts 17, you know, how the demons came together. But they were studying anything that they could hear, anything that was new. And then so when Paul started speaking, you know, about the truth, then now, hey, this is interesting. You want to know about what this, you know, what this is, you probably never heard this.
Absolutely. So again, God's looking for worshipers of him that will not take place in one place or another. And he's looking for those who will worship in spirit and in truth. So, regarding this true worship, okay. So again, we talk about the Samaritans and how they weren't worshiping according to truth. Let's talk about again Jewish worship at this time. And again, granted, I'm sure we're very devout Jews who are worshiping entirely appropriately. But what about the rulers of the Jews and what we read about in some of Jesus' discussion about those who worship God among the rulers of the Jews? And remember what Jesus said about the rulers of the Jews and their worship in Matthew chapter 6. That what did they do? How was their worship done? To please God from the heart? Their worship of God was done for what purpose? To be seen of men. Was their worship, again, truly, again, from themselves, just their heartfelt expression of adoration, of reverence to God? Or was it very outwardly, again, were they very focused on the ceremonial acts of worship? In terms of, again, the washing of the hands and having the water drip down and again, making sure that the proper acts were followed in a very outward sort of way. And again, in the condemnation of the Pharisees in Matthew 23, Jesus talked about the fact they were concerned about cleansing what part of themselves?
Outside.
The outside. What about their inside? So could you say that for a lot of the Pharisees and the rulers of the Jews that their worship was in spirit? When they're focused on, again, you know, the receiving the praise of men, again, the outward ceremony and so forth, the pomp and the circumstance, and that's not a general condemnation of all Jews, but there were many who did what they did in worship to be seen of men. Again, it was very outward in nature, and so what had the rulers of the Jews and those who argued that you should worship in Jerusalem, what had they stripped away from true worship by focusing on the outward form and ceremony of worship? They stripped away the spirit. It was no longer a matter of worshiping in spirit. They just, you know, again, you have heard that it was said, and you need to follow the traditions of the elders. But on the other hand, what had the Samaritans stripped away from worship by combining it with idolatrous practices? They may have been doing so from the heart and very zealous. And Paul talked about those who were zealous according to the law. They may have been zealous in terms of worshiping this unknown God. But what had they stripped away even hundreds of years before? The truth. And isn't it interesting? Jesus then, in this context, tells this Samaritan woman, God seeks those to worship Him who will worship in spirit. And again, almost a word to the Jewish Pharisees and leaders, that again, this outward ceremonial worship isn't going to cut it anymore. And it has to be in truth. That you can't make up your own form of worship. You can't decide how and where and so forth. You're going to worship according to the will of God. I just think it's interesting that He is really addressing the unacceptable worship of both some of the Jews and the Samaritans by saying worshiping in spirit and in truth. So, is there anything I want to do? And again, simply leave us with the point that Jesus says that true worship requires both. So, the plan is right now, I will not be here next Wednesday night. Jonathan will be teaching for me. But one thing I wanted to simply point out and perhaps plant in your mind is this. If you look at John chapter 4 and after Jesus had said, God is spirit, those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth, the woman said to Him, I know that Messiah is coming, He who is called Christ. When that one comes, He will declare all things to us. Maybe before next week. Think about this. Had Jesus declared anything to this woman? Were there some things that He had declared to her? That in her mind now, she's thinking, it's told to me that the Messiah would come and declare all things. Well, were there some things that Jesus had declared to her already that she would then associate with, again, the Messiah as the one who would declare all things? So, yeah, thank you for your time and attention and contributions tonight.